Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX GabFest for Thursday, August 24th, the 1800 Patriarchy Street edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. I am not alone in the studio today. I am joined by our special guest, Christina Cotarucci, who is a writer for Slate. Hi, Christina.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Ah, it's so exciting to be with a human in a space.
How flattering.
Any human would do. Anyone, just, you know, warm body. And June Thomas in New York, managing producer of Slate Podcast. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah, I'm really lonely because I'm here all on my own. It's terrible. I don't know how you do it. I'm so sad.
I know. It's really sad. I did enjoy listening to the podcast that I was not on, by the way. You guys did a great job.
Well, thank you.
I loved it. What a great show. Yeah, except it kind of like kept me watching The Bold Type is the problem, which is really not a show you should keep watching. And every week it becomes more like a safe space. And so every week I have to tell my children, the workplace is not like this. Your boss will not invite you to her home and pet you and hug you every time you look a little distressed. That is not what work is like, people.
Unless you work at Slate.
Exactly. Oh, my God. Anyway, well, we have a very, very special show. This is my perhaps favorite show of the year. It's the show where you, our listeners, have called in and left us questions, asking us if certain things that you've heard about in the news, in the culture, or in your own life, you are wondering if they are sexist. And we, the feminist goddess experts of the universe, get to decide whether they are sexist or not. So we are going to get that going. We'll play some of your messages, maybe not all of them. A couple of you wrote in. We may do those as well. And then a little about Slate Plus, June.
And if anybody doesn't know what Slate Plus is, it's Slate's membership program where fans of the magazine and our podcast help to support us. And if you enjoy this podcast and find it valuable, joining Slate Plus is a great way to support us. For just $35 for your first year, you can help cover the cost of producing these shows. And of course, in return, you'll get extended ad-free versions of this show. And this week, that extended version will include still more of the questions that you can only hear on Slate Plus. So if you want to support the XX GabFest, go to slate.com/XXPlus and join Slate Plus today.
I got to say something about our Slate Plus episodes. They are often the loosest and funniest, not by design. It's just like we get giddy in the Slate Plus for some reason. It has a kind of magical effect. It's like a drug. So you really should listen to the Slate Plus segments. They are raunchy and funny often. Wouldn't you agree, June?
I would. They're the funniest segments.
All right. Should we begin?
I'm drunk on power right now. Yes.
I guess kind of a two-parter. Essentially, with recent things about Joss Whedon in the news and Nick Robinson, my questions are, is it inherently sexist to have an affair? And secondly, is it always sexist to, as the kids say, slip into one's DMs? Love to hear you guys discuss it. Thanks so much.
Why are you laughing because of the as the kids say?
I'm laughing because of the note that was it.
It was from Daniel. Yeah.
Who left the great note and correction that the kids actually don't say slip into one's DMs. They say slide. Yeah. So his kids are going to have a bone to pick with him.
I also think it's the one's DMs. Like, I don't know, there's something...
Into one's direct messages.
Yes. Slip into one's DMs. That's the grammatically proper way to say it. I have never said it, either slip or slide. Slip so I have slide. Done it. A slip and slide.
You have into... done it? You've slipped into someone's
well,
DMs?
Well, does it have to be sexual? I mean,
yes.
Oh, forget it. Sorry. No, I have not done that. I thought it just meant like a thing you do sometimes when you're sending someone a private.
No, it's not like you don't slip into someone's DMs to ask for career advice.
All right, I'm doubly embarrassed now. All right, so there are so many questions here.
Just to give a little bit of background in case folks haven't heard, Joss Whedon, who of course is the creator of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and director of, you know, Avengers movies and so on, King Geek, and a self-declared feminist. His ex-wife, Kai Cole, who they were divorced last year, she wrote a letter that was published in The Wrap. It was a kind of open letter that declared him a hypocrite. She said that he had been deceiving her, that he was having affairs. She said he's not who he pretends to be. You know, she said it was hypocrisy because he sets himself up as a feminist, but then he behaved in a very unfeminist manner. And she said that she, as a result, she had had PTSD from the sort of the, you know, the cycle of deception and, you know, the fact that she just kind of couldn't trust her husband.
Okay, so Christina, what do you think about his wife's letter?
This is tough because I know that a lot of times people can do things that make them a jerk or a bad person, but it doesn't necessarily make them anti-feminist. At the same time, you know, the personal is, as the kids say, political. And, you know, heterosexual relationships are some of those things where the patriarchal dynamics replicate, where they find power, and that's kind of how they've endured over time, or one of the spaces where they've endured over time. So if, you know, you're in this heterosexual relationship treating the most important woman in your life like shit, you are saying in some way, I think, that women are a little bit less deserving of your respect. I also think there are a lot of ways to cheat. You can cheat and be immediately sorry. It's a lapse in judgment. You apologize. You never do it again. This doesn't sound like that kind of situation. Not that there's any good way to cheat, but it sounds like from, you know, her, she alleges that he was gaslighting her, that she confronted him about it. He denied it, acted like she was crazy, then tried to justify it to her. This sounds like a particularly hurtful way to cheat that kind of demonstrates that he, you know, doesn't think of this particular woman and perhaps women as a whole of deserving of his respect.
I disagree. Okay, so I live inside the patriarchal machine that is the heterosexual marriage, so that should maybe be the caveat.
What an address. Wow.
I know. It's like, 1800 Patriarchy Street is where my house is. I think that his wife's letter was a total abuse of outrage public feminist politics. That's a really shitty thing to say. But I don't think there's any relationship between lots of people cheat. The rates of cheating for at least for people like under 35 are no higher for men than they are for women. Mm. I don't think there's a particularly good way to cheat. But I think your husband cheating on you does not have much to do with what his public persona is necessarily. And I think that there are ways in which men are hypocrites. Like, you know, we talked about Casey Affleck a little bit. Like, I had a problem. Like, he was in this amazing movie. Not that he particularly claims to have feminist credentials. I see why. But the way he particularly treated the women who worked for him was problematic. He kind of kept making advances at women who were rejecting his advances. There's sort of well-documented kind of boorish behavior towards women who work for you or who are on your staff. Having an affair, to me, is a different category because it's not necessarily like anti-feminist. It's just like you're a bad husband and your wife can take it out on you for being a bad husband. But I don't think of having an affair as anti-feminist. Like, men have affairs, women have affairs, men are jerks, women are jerks, inside the context of their marriage. I can see why his wife would be like, oh, it makes me want to vomit when I read about him getting all these feminist credentials and all these women admiring him. But I don't think he's a hypocrite. I just think he's, like, a bad husband.
So you feel like he's being given an extra bad rap because of his self-declared feminism?
When I read his wife's account of what he did wrong, mm-hmm. I read an account of a guy who had an affair and was like a terrible husband. Like, many people have affairs, men and women have affairs. I didn't find anything in the particular way that he had affairs that made me think, oh, that he was abusive, say, like he took advantage of his position of power. Unless you guys think that it's inherently taking advantage of your position of power if you are the powerful director and you're having affairs with women who are probably younger than you and who work for you or who work with you.
That is,
if that's inherently shitty, then I guess yes. I guess yes. This is.
I mean, it is. She, in her letter, she didn't name names, which I think was a good call. But it did seem that some of the affairs, which were, you know, supposedly or allegedly numerous, were with actresses who were kind of working for him, essentially. You know, he was in charge of their employment, essentially. They were in shows that he was casting and that he was directing and all of that he was running, essentially. So mm-hmm. there was a power differential, a power dynamic. I mean, I guess let me ask then, let's kind of go, the questioner asked, is it inherently sexist to have an affair? If you're not Joss Whedon, if you're not a famous male feminist, is it always sexist to have an affair? I mean, I guess the answer is no, right?
No.
So this is about the specifics of him.
Yeah, this is, so it is not, we can't agree, it's not always sexist to have an affair, but there's like a gray area with, as I'm talking, I'm starting to back away from what I said, because now I'm remembering that people did say, like, there was a time when one of his actresses was pregnant and he got like really angry at her. Like, there was something besides the just having an affair that was on the list of things. I thought that kind of outing your husband for having an affair and then being anti-feminist was unfair, but there was other stuff he did.
Another thing that she said, again, you know, he hasn't responded to these allegations, but she was saying that he described it as like, oh, all of a sudden I have this fame. All of these young, needy, and aggressive women want to have sex with me and I can't touch them. It's like I have a disease. That's a kind of a gross way to think about sex.
Right.
And, you know, so maybe it's gross, but maybe it's not anti-feminist. I happen to think that the way he had these affairs over time, making her feel like she was crazy for thinking it was happening, sort of stringing her along and justifying it to himself because he was this powerful director, seems inherently anti-feminist to me. I agree that that affairs aren't always sexist. I think, personally, if it's a man cheating on a woman, most of the time it is.
Interesting. Why? Why is that any different than, you know, your girlfriend cheating on you?
Because there's a different power dynamic there. Maybe it's unfair to men, poor men. But I think the fact that you are, it's similar to, you know, if you're in a heterosexual relationship and the dude never cleans up after himself, so the woman is kind of either forced to clean up after him or live in a pigsty. Or if, you know.
That's so interesting. So it just carries, even though it's two individuals in a room who are in a relationship, there's nothing you can't get away from the fact that it just carries like baggage, like
years
of baggage and history. And it's not necessarily the individual man's fault. It's just the fact that he's in a man and this relation. Oh, this is so interesting. This is going to change my world. I'm going to have to move out of 1800 patriarchy.
Except that, I think that you can't get away from the fact that, you know, that men have been raised in a certain way, are socialized to behave in relationships in certain ways. I think that's why patriarchal dynamics, even in, you know, the woke bay relationships, a lot of times men will end up doing less housework. Women will end up doing more childcare. I'm sure, you know, you guys have obviously talked about that on Double X before, but it's, you know, no matter how good your intentions are, a lot of those patriarchal dynamics end up getting replicated. And I think cheating is usually, you know, is just kind of another thing to add to that list.
All right. So enough with Joss. The second part was about a video game journalist named Nick Robinson. And maybe we don't need to talk about Nick Robinson specifically, although I will tell you it is a great pleasure to read his shitty apology letter, which is just like all the Silicon Valley. It is hilariously like humble braggy, and it's the worst apology ever, ever. But slipping into the DMs, Christina O. Youth, we sliding into the DMs.
Good. Thanks for not making me correct you.
Is it one of these places where women get harassed online? Like, is that a phenomenon?
Yes, definitely. I think, and for me, you know, as a young woman on Twitter who's a journalist and so, you know, has her name out there maybe more than the typical Twitter user, I will get men in my DMs all the time just saying like, hey, hey there. And sometimes it'll be you're ugly and sometimes it'll be you're hot. But so many, it's just, hey. And it's annoying to feel like just because I'm a woman on Twitter, I have to deal with so many sliders sliding into my DMs. Also, no one's ever asked me for a nude. And I hope that me saying that on this podcast doesn't encourage people to go and ask me for one. But the situation that this listener presents, this guy, Nick Robinson, was asking women for nude photos, asking them to come give him blowjobs. That's a totally different. I think that the, you know, it's like being a woman in a bar. Men are going to come up and hit on you all the time. I think the fact that men do that more than women means it's a product of sexism. It doesn't necessarily mean that hitting on someone is sexist. But when you go so far as to be a prominent video game journalist asking women to send you nude photos randomly on Twitter when they're just trying to, you know, share a meme or maybe do their jobs because they're also a journalist or they're a PR person.
Or even in this case, they were his fans. It's still not cool. Like, these were women who may have sent him admiring notes saying, I love your writing. This is so cool. Here's my video game. Whatever it is that they were sending to him, still not cool.
Especially uncool, I think, because it's apparently a lot of the women were women who worked in the video game industry, which is a tough world for women to start off with, but then to also have to deal with a guy who had kind of a lot of power. You know, he's a writer, he's on a popular podcast, he's a popular YouTuber in the gaming world. And so this was a guy who had power, not just this, you know, ambient vague male power or, you know, the power of the patriarchy. He had particular specific power. And there he was, instead of, like, you know, respecting them and, you know, dealing with them as humans, it was just, you know, can I have a nudie?
Okay, so just to summarize, having an affair, not especially sexist. Joss Whedon, I think I was on the minority on that one. Sexist, that whole situation. He should have his feminist credentials at least partially removed.
Mm-hmm.
Right, June? That's where we landed on that one. Sliding into women's DMs, sexist. I mean, unless it's like your friend or you have a question or you think it's like a legit...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think just reminding women who are just trying to be women that they're not only women, they're also, you know, sex objects when they're just trying to do their thing is sexist.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Allison. I'm a primary care provider in a suburban clinic in the Twin Cities in Minnesota. And I have a question for your hosts about, is this sexist? I work in a clinic that has men and women providers, and we are trying to hire a new provider for our patients, but it's sort of a thing in primary care that men will go to men primary care providers and women will go to women primary care providers. And the truth is we would like to hire another male provider because we don't have a whole lot of male primary care providers that are open to new patients. But I wonder if it's sexist because are we just perpetuating these preconceived notions that only men know men's issues? Or are we actually being super sensitive to patient needs and having the right providers for the right people? Certainly if the roles were reversed, we would say that women should be able to see women providers. Anyhow, I'd be curious to know what your panel would think. Thank you very much.
Okay, so I am a little bit torn here because, you know, I think as much as I, in some ways, my first response is, get over it, you know, see a provider. You don't have to have the same gender identity, you know, to have your bunions treated. You know, so that's my first response. At the same time, I do want to be aware that it's important for people to get treatment. If their feelings are so strong that it's preventing them from getting treatment and from going to see a doctor when they need to, then I kind of feel, well, maybe we should accommodate it. But even as I say that, I'm like, so if a white person said, I'm sorry, I only want to see a white doctor, I'd be like, no, that is not acceptable. So am I just being, you know, too accommodating? Am I giving up too much when it's not, you know, a matter of something that has to do with, you know, some bodily configuration that they share? So I'm a little bit torn, but on the whole, I think it's sexist for the patient to want to see a male doctor. At the same time, I understand you might want to, you know, hire more male providers so that people who want to can be accommodated and therefore get the treatment that they need. Am I being too soft and squishy?
I disagree with you, June. I think it's not sexist at all.
Oh.
I will only see women doctors. I think part of it, you know, you never know what a doctor's got going on under their
right.
white jackets.
Right.
Or their scrub pants. But, you know, you can be reasonably sure that, you know, you share a certain genital configuration, as I think you said, June.
I think you said gender identity.
Gender identity. I think there's something about someone, you know, touching your body and certain intimate body parts that it's not weird to want to see somebody who shares a gender with you. I think, you know, that men probably aren't asking to see male providers because they think women are incompetent doctors or because women are incapable of diagnosing or treating them. They're, you know, so-called men's issues or whatever. But I think that it's normal and not strange for somebody to, you know, feel more comfortable talking about what may be really embarrassing or intimate issues with somebody of their own gender.
Yeah, I get
that. Wow, I did not predict that Christina was going to say that. I thought that because I was in the mindset of 1800 Patriarchy Street, I was like,
I don't always live there.
I know, but I thought you were going to say,
rather,
like,
I visit there occasionally.
Because there is actually a long sexist history of male doctors mansplaining to women,
right?
And that there could be, apart from people's individual needs, a kind of desire to have women be the kind of generic authorities in medical practice, and particularly something like family practice, in the way that men have been the general authority. So it was always taken for granted that a man would know what to do with a woman's body. And so do you need to just, like, historically correct and just make women the kind of standard? Because the truth is that a man could see a woman, you know, my closest friend is a primary care provider, and, like, she has male patients, she has female patients, and in fact her male patients love her because she's a woman, so she's like their mom, you know, taps into other sexist stereotypes. but maybe you're right, you don't need to correct the patriarchy in every private interaction.
Forcing men to see women doctors is not necessarily the best way to go about correcting that historic wrong.
So can she actually, how can they do that? Do they have to just discriminate quietly against women in the interviews? I mean, I don't think you can advertise saying
men only,
please.
Yeah. That's a great question that we should pose to that listener.
So not sexist. We can say not sexist.
See,
right?
I still think it is sexist. And I think, because as I say, I definitely think that there are times when there is an interest. It's, I mean, it does seem different for women and for men. It seems much more clear to me why a woman would want to see a woman than why a man would want to see a man.
Wait, what? Why?
Because there is this whole history of sexist medicine and, you know, male doctors being very condescending and you know, woman body splaining to women. Whereas, and I think also there are more sort of, there's more gynecological functions and, you know, female body functions than there are male body functions that involve the medical providers.
That's crazy. What about the whole, like, turn your head and cough situation?
Yeah, I have erectile dysfunction. I have a business on my prostate. I have, I can't have sex, whatever it is.
There's dick issues, but women have have also reproductive issues that men have fewer of, you know, that men don't go, and men aren't supposed to go to a particular doctor about their gender anatomy on a regular basis. I don't know how often women are supposed to go, because I haven't been for years. But
I love June woman-splaining man bodies right now.
It's just like a trunk with a dick. What do they need
it's
a doctor
really
for?
Simple, yeah.
But I'm going to continue as if you hadn't said anything. But I do think it's sexist, but I also do see that as long as it's not about disrespecting female providers, then I do think it should be accommodated as much as it can. I don't know how they go about doing it, because if they get like fantastic female applicants and mediocre male applicants, are they really going to take the male because they really need a male doctor? Or provider.
Making an anti-affirmative action argument here.
Why don't we just weigh it on the scale a little more? Like, that can be one of the things they take into account, that men might prefer to see a male provider, but it doesn't have to be an absolute. Like, when they're interviewing their candidates, if it's like a fabulous female candidate, they shouldn't discount her, but they can give some weight to the fact that men,
that they
know,
have a shortage
20%
in that area.
Weight. Yeah, yeah, the shortage in that area. Okay, somewhat sexist.
Hi, I'm Dana Agee from Nashville, Tennessee, and my Is It Sexist question is, are teachers living and working in a very sexist institution? Teachers are expected to be selfless. That's part of why we're expected to take less pay, to work extra hours without extra compensation, to go to trainings over the summer and weekends, even when we're 10-month contract employees. And I really believe that it is very sexist that teachers are expected to do all this extra work without extra compensation or without extra negotiating power in their job. And a big piece of me thinks that teachers are allowing sexism to really just kind of take over their lives by accepting these jobs for the sake of a labor of love. Thanks for the show. I love you all very much, and I'm glad to call in today. Bye-bye.
All right, I'll start. I don't know about the particulars, because I think a lot of people in lots of different situations work overtime and not compensated for them, particularly in creative fields. I will say, as a parent who's been through many schools, I think on a societal level, it's definitely sexist. It is definitely one of the great examples of a profession that's undervalued and underpaid because women work in it. Full stop, period. That is the reason we don't pay teachers as much as teachers should be paid. I often look around the school and I'm like, wow, this is just a giant matriarchy of people who work really hard and are very selfless and are totally underpaid. And we have a female principal. It's not like, you know, it's not like we have a big sort of patriarchal situation in our school. I just feel like it is a glaring area of sexism in our day-to-day life, how schools are.
I was really surprised that, I've never having attended a school in the United States, I was, you know, kind of looking up, well, how many teachers are women? And I was surprised at the extent of female domination of the field. Like, more than 3/4 of kindergarten to high school teachers are women, and that's up from 2/3 30 years ago. So it's becoming more and more female dominated. In elementary and middle schools, more than 80% of teachers are women. In high schools, 42% of high school teachers are male, but men who do go into teaching are promoted more. Nearly half of school principals are men. So there is this incredible, like, and I could quote more of this kind of statistic. Like, it was just shocking to me that that was the situation. And it seems really clear that, as you said, Hannah, this situation wouldn't be so. There would be better terms and conditions if there were more men in the field, and probably more men don't come into the field because of the terms and conditions. That said, there are certain reasons why, apparently, it is more attractive to women, again, because of patriarchal conditions where women are expected to do more childcare. A lot of women do prefer teaching because essentially they work the same hours as their kids. You know, a very similar schedule. You know, the summer's off, and it's a very much easier to return to teaching after, you know, taking time out for having kids than it is in other fields, again, because of the female domination.
That's one of the reasons why I feel it's like a cementing of sexism, because teacher is one of those things that kind of like fixes every stereotype in place. Like, why don't dads want to have the summers off with their kids? Yeah. And it turns out to be somewhat of a myth that they work the same hours as their children, because teachers have to come in wicked early so they can almost never take their own kids to school. Like, my friends who are teachers and my relatives who are teachers actually have a more stressful life, because like, you go in thinking that, but then it's like, oh shit, turns out I have to stay for another 2 hours to grade the paper. Right. It's actually a really hard job. And so, and it cements the idea that like, women do it because it's their role to be home earlier because their kids are home earlier. Like, and also it's like, there's some sort of like cultural, I bet there's like a cult in the same way when we talked about male nurses, that there's a little bit of cultural discomfort with, say, male elementary school teachers. Like every single stereotype is kind of echoed and reinforced in the massive gender imbalance in schools, which is not great for boys either. Like, why doesn't my son have a single, he has never had a male teacher.
Really?
It's insane. So he has no, like, he has no, my little son, so he's no image in his head of like, oh, it's totally fine to be like a male second grade teacher. Actually, there is one male third grade teacher in the school. It just happened to be not be his teacher, but there's so few role models. So it just gets like perpetuated.
And on its face, I would initially think that was great, that all these male kids are forced to have, you know, female leaders in their lives. But I think when you're talking about especially elementary school teachers and even middle school teachers, it's like, you know, they're taking the place of your mom.
Yes.
And then the men are off somewhere doing the real work.
Until high school.
Or being the principals, like June said.
Right. Or being the principal. Yeah, it does. It should work that way, but it doesn't end up working that way because it's just too, it's too glaring. Like, if it was like 40-60%, it would feel a little more even. Anyway, you go, sister. We're with you on this one. 100% sexist. Now we're going to do one that we got through email from Danielle Kincaid. Christina, do you want to read her letter?
Sure. I'm a 29-year-old divorced mom to a toddler, and I also am working full-time at a not-so-great job while putting myself through grad school for a second master's degree. Wow, Danielle. Somehow, I find myself dating a wonderful guy who is just great to me and my child. He's very much a quote-unquote woke bae who supports my ambitions and loves my mind. The only real problem is that there's a major difference in our finances. He's self-employed and having a record year while I'm supporting my little family without a lot of wiggle room. He enjoys travel and the finer things in life, but is self-made and appreciates simple things too. Is it sexist for me to let him pay my way? In the beginning, we joked about date nights being on him because it was the least he could do with the wage gap. But recently, we've had a few weekends away while my child was with its father, and I couldn't help doing the mental addition of cost. Furthermore, as things get more serious, he's started giving me some pretty lavish gifts in blue boxes with white ribbon. How do I reconcile feminism with the perks of my relationship?
This one is really hard.
Yeah. I love that euphemism, blue boxes with white ribbon. And it rhymes with schmiffanies.
Oh, boy.
I'm going to start this because I've always been just astonished to learn that in heterosexual dating, In fact, it seems most cases, the man is expected to pay, at least in the early dates. And I totally get, you know, from visiting 1800 Patriarchy Street, that men typically earn more, that they, you know, there's just a lot more sort of wiggle room for them. But it still feels very unfair in general. However, given that in this case, in this particular specific case, there has been a kind of a, you know, it's been an open discussion that there is, you know, there is an inequality. He's fine with it. Maybe you should learn to be fine with it, Danielle, because it sounds like if the roles were reversed and you had a similar situation and, again, there was this kind of communication and just talking about, like, are we okay with this? You would pay more than your fair share if you had more to give. So although the whole underpinnings of heterosexual dating seem kind of sexist to me, I also think that in this particular case, it's more just a reflection of reality and not particularly sexist. Like, you do seem just to be doing this with all eyes open, and that feels much more just, it's a matter of this particular people, these particular people and their circumstances.
I agree. I don't think it's sexist. I think it would be sexist if he were demanding things from Danielle, like, you know, I paid for this trip. I need you to, you know, clean my house while mm-hmm. I'm off working mm-hmm. at my self-employed, whatever, startup.
Yeah.
I think this is, like you said, June, it feels like just a reflection of the reality of their financial situations. It sounds like they have a fantastic relationship. So, yeah, I hope Danielle can learn to enjoy and not feel guilty about, you know, the feminist implications of accepting a
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. What happened to the why? Why isn't it just like the Joss Whedon situation where, like, there, even though, like, why do we care about the particulars of these two individuals? Like, didn't we start the show saying there's, like, the weight of the patriarchy on every relationship?
Yes.
And so, like, he carries the history of what June calls the sort of shockingly sexist structure of all heterosexual relationships. So if it were reversed, we would be totally cool with it, but it's not reversed. So isn't that where the complication comes in? Like, as much as they love each other and everything's cool, aren't they representing? This is like what stay-at-home moms always worried about. Like, even though it's a particular decision that comes out of particular considerations, aren't they representing something that that props up the patriarchy? Ladies.
I think it, for me, the fact that she is working a full-time job and putting herself through grad school also makes a difference. So it's not like she is, you know, not working because he's paying for all of her daily needs. It's that, you know, they both want to go on a trip together. He's able to pay and she's not.
At this moment in time, right.
Okay, and I think that at a certain point, you know, maybe she'll be able to contribute more when she's not paying for school. But if not, you know, I think I might also be biased because I am in a relationship where I'm a journalist and my partner is a, you know, PR VP. So I'm in a relationship where the more feminine partner is earning a lot less. And it took me a while to get comfortable with having her pay for things. And then I got to a point where I figured, you know, I don't want to hold my partner back from, mm-hmm. you know, going out to dinner or something because I can't pay. And if she is willing to pay, then, you know, I can get over myself. I also think it makes a difference that he's, from this question at least, it seems like he is putting in the work with, you know, well, I'll take that back. I don't know if he's actually helping care for her child, but
yeah, the blue boxes and why. I was like, oh, is he moving towards a more traditional, you know, that was the one thing where it felt like, oh, mm-hmm. is he moving toward, like in my experience of heterosexual dating, which is the only kind of dating I've done, you can get a whiff. And I was, without even being conscious of this in my 20s, I knew it, of men who have that expectation deep in their soul, no matter what words are coming out of their mouth. Like, I didn't know that that's how I was choosing a man, but that is how I was choosing a man in retrospect. Uh-huh. So, like, everybody's a woke bae, probably, that I, you know, that I dated, right. Certainly by the standards of woke bae in my day. And so it was like, but you just kind of knew, like, it was in the way they talked about their mom. Like, you could see that if their vision of their future life involved a hierarchy or not. Because I realized, as you were talking about your personal situation, that my personal situation is my personal opinions are probably influenced by the fact that my husband and I were equals for the most part. Like, we worked relatively equal jobs. We made about the same amount of money, like one more, one less, one year or another year. But like, I really haven't been in this situation. So I haven't had to really like grapple with what it would be like.
Hello, this is Kelly. And my question is, my boss has a 3-person team. There are 2 females and 1 male. For the holidays this year, he gave us some wine. The females got white and the male got red. Is this sexist? Thank you.
I love that so much. Oh, boy. I ran this by everyone, like the ladies I work with, and they were like, yes.
Yeah, this is kind of a hilariously clear-cut example of sexism. Yeah. Like, you didn't even try to hide it there. The boss, you know, the ladies like their Chardonnay.
But is it sexist or stereotypy? Or, like, what is it? I think the confusion comes from the fact of, like, is it harmful? Like, it's clearly, like I don't know, sex stereotypist or something. Mm-hmm. But like, what does it say about, why do we laugh at it? It's really funny and it's kind of gauche. But is it sexist implies that it causes harm in the world? Or
I guess because it feels like it's, you know, if we're making these distinctions for things like wine, it just reveals something. It reveals that the boss thinks of the women differently than he thinks of the man on the team. And so even though in this particular case, whether you get a bottle of Pinot Gris instead of a bottle of, I don't know, Tempranillo, like that is in itself pretty or even totally harmless, it just reveals something about the way the boss thinks, which is kind of disturbing.
And I think the stereotype that women like white wine stems from this idea that women have less sophisticated palates, that they can only handle sweet drinks and not, you know, full-bodied, whatever, dry drinks.
I was thinking it's like a manly thing, like the like red meat and red wine. Like the men get the kind of earthy,
the bloody,
manly, bloody drink.
The mead.
Oh, my God.
So is it sexist? Yes.
Yes. You don't have to quit your job. You just have to, like, you know, maybe you just have to, like, find ways to make fun of his gender.
And drink scotch at work.
Drink scotch, wear overalls every day, Kelly. All right. We're going to do our last question before our recommendations.
Hi, XXX. This is Catherine. My question is it sexist to think that a man's skinny pants are too skinny? No one ever seems to complain that a woman's pants are too tight, at least not too often. But somehow it's common to say, like, oh, that guy's pants are way too tight. All right, thanks.
I have to say, I take great pleasure in men wearing skinny pants and dealing with their beards and their hair and all that shit, because I'm like, that's right. That's how it is, gentlemen. It is a pain in the ass and it is uncomfortable, and welcome to my world. So I'm always really happy, but I've never thought a guy's pants were too tight.
Really? Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Like, too skinny for your taste, too skinny for the workplace. I agree with you, Hannah, that I think the more men wearing skinny pants and experiencing, like, pelvic discomfort, the better. I think complaining about the tightness of a guy's pants just because there might be some bulges that you don't necessarily see in a woman's tight pants, that's probably sexist. Stop complaining about people's pants being too tight, no matter the gender.
See, I have definitely thought, wow, that guy's pants are tight.
You're so sexist.
I know, right? I'm realizing that now. But I don't think it's, I mean, maybe it is sexist to think it, but I don't think it's a problem. But I do think it would be a problem to, like, say it out loud. I mean, in most situations, if you're just really just in a kind of sip and dish mode, then sure, you can talk about anything. You know, the world's your oyster. But it doesn't seem any less wrong to discuss the specifics or to critique the specifics of a man's appearance than a woman's appearance.
So your view is it's
but
just
think it by all means.
What's sexist? But think it by all means. What's sexist about it is the same thing that like we just shouldn't comment on if we want it to be better for women. We just shouldn't comment on, you know, Paul Ryan's pecs or whatever. Like we should never just mention how people look or anything like that.
I said that sounds so that like deprives the world of so many good topics of conversation. I mean, Paul Ryan's oversized suits. That's a great topic, and I don't really feel sexist for having talked about that. But I don't know, something like there are degrees of these things, like the way a person wears their pants, especially if it's that they're very tight and revealing, then that moves into sort of territory that maybe is too personal, whereas like just some basic, you know, critiquing, I think I don't want to take that off the table.
Just out of curiosity, do you ever, as you're walking down the street, think women's pants are too tight? I'm just curious.
I don't often think they're too tight. I do notice that sometimes people wear unflattering garments, and sometimes that's because they're too tight. But I don't really, it doesn't, I can't say that men's over-tight pants bothers me. I just kind of think, wow, you know, gosh, that seems awfully tight. And I think typically it's at the workplace. Because, you know, I think men tend to just kind of wear the same pants wherever, whereas women are more likely to have, I mean, in a casual type workplace, of course, women tend to have, you know, more distinguished wardrobes for work and leisure, more distinct wardrobes for work and leisure. So I don't know. I can't say that too tight or anything like that. I just notice it more about guys, I guess, because it surprises me more.
Yeah, I think I would appreciate it. I mean, if I lived in New York, I'd probably roll my eyes because every man would have his pants like beautifully tailored and too tight. But it's not really the case here. So I appreciate a man. I'm with you, Christina. A man, like a well-tailored man, it's fine. Just like a well-tailored woman. It's just nice to look at.
I agree with that.
All right. So what did we decide about that one?
I don't think it's sexist to think it, but I think it's just as sexist to say, to kind of call out a man's pants as it would be to call out a woman's clothing.
Okay, that's a good place to land. All right. Well, thank you all listeners for your fabulous, fabulous questions. I love your is it sexist in your life questions. They really teach us a lot. And I would say keep them coming because when we get good ones, we sometimes use them for our Slate Plus is it sexist segment. And before we get to Slate Plus, let us do our recommendations. June, why don't you go first today?
So this is an unusual type of recommendation for me because I don't really know many children's books, but I read and came across and read and totally loved a children's book, you know, one of those illustrated books, you know, for the tiny tots. It's called Tea with Oliver, and it's by Mika Song, and it's the cutest thing. It's about letter writing. It's about a cat called Oliver who wants to have a tea party, and the mouse who lives under his couch, Filbert, wants to have a tea party with him, but he doesn't know how, so he's writing letters to Oliver, and the letters kind of, you know, there's like a Tess of the D'Urbervilles thing where the letters don't get delivered properly, and when the letters, you know, reach their destination and they communicate, it's the most wonderful thing. And also the artwork is fantastic. So Tea with Oliver, it's one of the best books I've read in a long time.
Oh my God, that was the cutest thing ever. Yeah. So cute. I have to say that as my children have aged out of illustrated books and like here, I love illustrated books. Children's books are just like they're just cultural artifacts and they're so beautiful and we don't give them nearly as much love as they deserve. They are fabulous and I'm so sad to be out of that era of reading and looking at illustrated books. They are just beautiful. I love them. Okay, well, there's a little bit of a theme to our recommendations because I'm recommending a kind of book that I read a lot of great things and watched a lot of great things while I was on vacation.
Oh, yeah.
But the one I'm about to recommend is a genre of book I never read, which is apocalyptic, which everyone else in my family reads. And I'm just like, ugh. They're all the same. So, but I read this book by a local author named Daniel Wilson, local that is to Portland, Oregon, which is where I was vacationing. And it's called Robopocalypse. And it's by Daniel Wilson. And it was optioned by Steven Spielberg. And I really hope he makes the movie because it's another one of these kind of AI robot apocalypse things. But it actually totally convinced me that the robots are coming. And so it taught me exactly how that was going to happen. So it was simultaneously educational as well as apocalyptic. And it's amazing. It's written in these kind of separate chapters of sort of like how the robots come and the sort of these particular incidents. It's incredibly visual. And then just kind of the heroes that are going to take our world back. And it's a book about like what makes us human. It's amazing.
Wow. Anyway. Sounds great.
Yeah, I loved it. Okay, Christina.
So I recently watched The Incredible Jessica James on Netflix. It stars Jessica Williams, who I love. I don't know if I would recommend the movie as a whole. I actually didn't think it was a great vehicle for her comedic chops, which I really appreciate. However, there are two things that I would like to recommend about it. The first is the soundtrack. It features a local to D.C. Band, X-Hex, one of my favorites. And I've been listening to the Spotify playlist since I watched the movie. The main thing I want to recommend about it is the baby shower scene. I don't think I have felt so seen by a scene in a movie in a long time. So the premise is this woman who's sort of like this, you know, creative feminist from New York goes back home to, I think, Ohio, to her younger sister's baby shower. And she's just sort of surrounded by like suburban horrors. And like her sister doesn't want her to wear her crazy jumpsuit to her baby shower. And she gives her sister this like feminist book. I think it's like P is for patriarchy or something like that. And she's just met with these blank stares by all of like the moms and suburban friends of her little sister. And, you know, having recently been through the pageantry of my own sister's baby shower and baby's birth and, you know, wedding showers and all of the other trappings of 1800 patriarchy street. It was amazing to watch this memorialized in a film. And I think the, you know, there's like clips of like death metal or something when they show like all the weird like gender reveal-y type. It was so good. And yeah, if you don't watch the movie, at least try to fast forward to that scene.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Even for me. All right.
Before we go, I'd just like to do a little plug for another Slate podcast, the Audio Book Club. This is one of Slate's longest running podcasts, currently sort of ring-led by the great Katie Waldman. So they, you know, discuss new and important books. And the August book is Arundhati Roy's The Ministry of Utmost Happiness. It hasn't been recorded yet, but it will be available next week. And it's going to be Katie, Isaac Chotner, who's interviewed Roy for his podcast, I Have to Ask, and the great Slate Books critic, Laura Miller. I think that's going to be a spectacular episode, and it will be available next week.
Thank you, June. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks to our fabulous producer, Vera Lynn Williams. Thanks to our wonderful intern, Daniel Schrader. For Christina and June, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you. With professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.